This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why higher prices would actually be good for us, how the foreclosure crisis might end, and what happens when hotels stop cleaning guest rooms. Oh yeah, it's Friday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, today the 15th of October. Good to have you with us. There is quite possibly nothing we put on the radio that is more tedious than a speech by the chairman of the Federal Reserve. That said, sometimes you got to do what you got to do. So with apologies, Ben Bernanke did give a speech this morning about how else the Fed might unstick the American economy. Even though we all pretty much knew what he was going to say, actually hearing it really got everybody's attention.
The FOMC is prepared to provide additional accommodation if needed to support the economic recovery and to return inflation over time to levels consistent with our mandate.
So to translate, if I might, additional accommodation means the Fed is going to push interest rates even lower. Getting inflation consistent with their mandate actually means getting prices higher. A good thing, in that that generally means a growing economy. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the details.
The Fed has already lowered short-term rates to near zero, so it's all about the long-term rates. And to bring those down, the Fed has to buy assets like Treasury bonds, so many of them that the interest rate on those bonds begins to fall. It's a process called quantitative easing. And Kevin Flanagan, chief fixed income strategist at Morgan Stanley, says the effect is threefold.
To reduce borrowing costs.
On things like mortgages to aid the housing market.
To help more risky assets. In other words, when you bring down yield levels, they become less attractive and investors may want to turn their attention to other riskier type assets.
Meaning sell those bonds and buy some stocks to boost the stock market.
But something even more important is what it could do for exports, because traditionally when you go down the path of quantitative ease, it tends to depreciate your currency.
So other countries want to buy more of our goods, and the number of manufacturing jobs rises. So might the inflation rate, and a little bump would be a sign that consumers are back in the game. The Fed is hoping the inflation rate will double from 1% to 2%. But former Fed economist Anne Owen of Hamilton College says,
what the concern is that because of the momentum, they won't be able to stop it. It's really hard to put the brakes on without skidding, and I think that's what the people who are concerned about inflation are worried about.
And even Ben Bernanke admitted today he's heading into uncharted waters. But for now, deflation appears to be the central bank's biggest fear. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This morning's release of the Consumer Price Index, it was basically flat, pretty much seals the deal for 58 million Social Security recipients. Their annual cost of living increases are tied to inflation, and since there isn't any, they're not going to get a bump this year for the second year in a row. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
Social Security benefits have been tied to a consumer price index since 1975. But Barbara Kennelly of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare says that index does not take health care costs into account.
And what do seniors spend their money on? A good part of their check is spent on health care, medicines, doctors.
Kennelly says retirees are falling behind. But Alicia Munell at the Center for Retirement Research says poverty among seniors actually declined last year, That's because Social Security recipients got a 5.8% cost of living increase in early 2009, plus a $250 per person payment from the stimulus bill.
Social Security recipients are being treated absolutely equitably. There is no harm being done to them.
Still, President Obama and Democrats in Congress are proposing to give veterans and Social Security beneficiaries another $250 stimulus check. They say the economy will benefit, since retirees are likely to spend those checks right away. But deficit watchdogs, like Maya McGinnis at the Committee for a Responsible Budget, argue it would be better to stimulate job creation more directly and leave Social Security alone.
The concern, of course, is that seniors are a very influential group, and we're a few weeks before an election, and that there'll be political pressures to pay out more money for Social Security beneficiaries.
Democrats say they'll bring up the stimulus for seniors bill when Congress returns in November. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Wall Street was a tale of three indices today, each doing their own thing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The economic through line this week, and last week for that matter, was of course the foreclosure mess. Who owns which mortgage, and did the banks play fast and loose with their paperwork? Our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond today, however, is going to start with the spot news of the day, Ben Bernanke and that speech this morning. Here to chat this week are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Felix Salmon from Reuters. Good to talk to you both again.
Good to be here, Kai.
Great to be here.
All right, so we will resume where Jeremy Hobson left off at the beginning of the broadcast, talking about Ben Bernanke and his plans to save the American economy. Felix, is it going to work?
No, we're going to. And I think Ben Bernanke actually admitted as such in his speech. He was saying that unemployment is going to stay high, that the Fed is going to do its best to try and bring it down, but it's not ultimately going to be very successful, at least not in the near term.
Lee, save us here, will you? Give us some hope.
Well, look, I mean, his prediction was gloomy, but it was a lot of gloomy stuff we already know. Will this next quantitative easing 2, QE2, as they call it, you know, don't we wish that still referred to a really fancy cruise ship?
Which, by the way, I have been on, but anyway.
You have?
Yeah, wow. Oh, yeah. I was a little kid. Yeah, you bet.
But deflation is the big new threat here. You know, when you're talking about targeting inflation and deflation, it's a very hard thing to get exactly right. And then the other issue is just that a lot of this relies on companies spending, right? I mean, companies are not spending. That is such an important part of the economy. But companies have more cash than you can imagine right now. And so having the money to spend is not the problem. It's an issue of confidence.
But yeah, Lee makes a good point. Ben Bernanke is essentially throwing lots and lots of money at the economy and saying, spend this, lend this.
Right.
And then the banks and the companies, they're not lending it and they're not spending it. And he made the point that we don't really know with any great specificity how normal monetary policy works. But we know that much better than we know about this quantitative easing. No one's really done it enough in the past to have any predictive power about what kind of effect it may or may not have in the future.
Well, so Felix, we're not going to know when we know, right? It's just going to happen and all of a sudden it's going to be, oh, look, it worked.
Or it didn't, or it went too far and now we've got too much inflation. We know that the future is more uncertain now than it has been in years. That Ben Bernanke is doing his best, but he is looking into a black hole. And he more or less admits that.
I'm flabbergasted, actually, that we're having this conversation about uncertainty and black holes and not knowing what's coming. Lee, it's been 2.5 years, right? And we still don't know what we don't know?
Not only do we not know what we don't know, but we're seeing things like with this whole mortgage mess,
yeah.
Okay? That's a perfect example of there being still deep, dark corners and pockets of the financial crisis that we are only just now learning about. So what else are we missing? What else is out there that's going to surface that we're going to have to – it's going to be a new regulatory hole that we're going to plug up after the fact?
To be fair to Bernanke, though, Kai, it used to be the case that we didn't know what we didn't know. Now we do know what we don't know. So in that sense, it's an advance.
I feel like I'm trapped in Donald Rumsfeld's Hall of Mirrors here, right? The unknown unknowns. Let me take
exactly.
A very quick pivot on the way out here, Felix, and turn to this mortgage thing. You've been writing about it a lot. You are not sanguine that this is going to end well.
In fact, I'm pretty sure it's going to end badly. Mm-hmm. There's an enormously higher risk of a very, very ugly, bad outcome now than there was just a few weeks ago. And we don't know where this is going to end.
I'm going to invoke the spirit of our friend and sometimes Friday participant John Carney, who posted this morning on his blog that it's not going to end badly. He said, you know what? The government's going to come in and fix this and pass some kind of bill, and it's all going to go away because Congress can't say no to the banks. Lee, what do you think?
You know, I love John, but I just don't think it's that simple. I think that, you know, the housing crisis was already stalled in a dangerous way before this all happened. This is going to stall it more. It's not good.
John is playing what's known as the moral hazard trade here. The idea that the federal government is going to sweep in with another multi-billion dollar rescue and we're all going to be fine. And at some point that game doesn't work anymore, and I don't think that Congress is going to come in. I don't even think it can. This is all being done state by state. I don't think there's any federal law which could fix this.
Well, not yet, until they pass it, right? I mean, there was no law about the TARP until they came up with it.
But at least that was a nationwide thing. Mortgages are written in states. They're not written under federal law.
Felix Salmon from Reuters, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Nobody's happy about the state of the economy or that the planet's getting warmer or that big companies often steamroll the little guy, but few of us do anything about it. Well, that's where the yes men come in. Mike Bonanno and Andy Bicklebaum dish out their brand of corporate comeuppance in pranks and stunts that get worldwide attention with some high-profile victims, too. Mike Bonanno is here to chat about what they do. Mike, good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Where did this idea come from, lo, these many years ago?
The idea for the yes men was to criticize people in power who were doing bad things and to do it on their own turf.
Did you and your friend Andy just sort of sit down one day and said, listen, we got to do this?
No, it just happened to us. Andy had put up a fake website for the WTO before the Seattle protests. We didn't expect people to take it seriously because it was satirical. And then people actually believed it, even though we suggested things like opening a free market in democracy by selling votes directly to the highest bidder over the internet.
Let me fast forward a couple of years to what I would say was probably your highest profile prank, for want of a better word, about Dow Chemical taking responsibility for the Bhopal incident 25, 30 years ago, where a gas leak killed 2,500-something people. I guess it was Andy went on the BBC. You got an interview on the BBC, and you came out and said, we, Dow Chemical, are taking full responsibility for the Bhopal tragedy. We will pay reparations. It got incredible play.
Yeah, it was the number one item on Google News that day, and then even the retraction, revelation that it was a hoax, was then the number one item on Google News. You know, it should be, because Dow was washing their hands of the responsibility for the largest industrial accident in history. We've developed a culture that is very invested in handing over ethics to the imperatives of profit. And we really need to shift that, because otherwise the whole planet actually is in peril.
You guys have taken up sustainability recently. You had a big thing year and a half ago at the Chamber of Commerce in Washington. You went in there, had a fake press conference and said, you know what? The Chamber of Commerce is reversing its stance. We are now going to take on global warming and do something about it.
You know, it's about constructing this alternative reality in which suddenly these real bad guys who are doing real nasty things could listen to their sense of morality and justice and do the right thing. In the case of the Chamber, they did sue us, and we still have a pending lawsuit. They claim that we're not trying to criticize them for any other reason than making money, which is a total joke, of course, because we don't make money. But we teach at universities. That's how we get by. The Yes Men loses money at the scale of our ambition.
And you're proud of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The bigger we get, the more money we lose.
You know, the financial crisis, it seems to me, would be like mother's milk for you guys. It is the crisis that keeps on giving of corporate scandal. And yet I don't recall, and maybe I'm wrong, I don't recall you guys really having done anything about it.
No, but if you put all the pieces together from the various different actions that we've carried out, then you can see a picture that's critical of the sort of casino capitalism that got us in that position. And it was doing the work for us. You know, we don't have as much work to do when the system is imploding, you know, because people see a reason to criticize it. And one of the problems that we face now is that all of the effort is about getting the system back on track, when in fact, we have a great opportunity to change the system entirely.
What's next? Where do you guys go from here?
Well, we plan you know, within the next couple of days to bring capitalism as we know it to its knees.
Call me and just let me know, all right?
All right. Yeah, we're working on it.
Mike Bonanno, he is one of the S-Men. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, yes, not cleaning a hotel room does save energy, but
the room is very bad. It's really filthy, dirty, dusty.
The downside of going green, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials threw off 0.2%. Today, 31 points closed at 11,062. The NASDAQ picked up 1.3%, 33 points, finished at 2,468. The S&P 500 was also on the upside. It added 0.2%, 2 points, ended things at 1,176. For the week, the Dow climbed 0.5%. The NASDAQ shot up 2.75%. The S&P 500 padded on just under 1%. The foreclosure mess hung over financials again today, but Bank of America had double trouble. Its shares fell nearly 5%, in part on news that Angelo Mozzillo, the former head of Countrywide Financial, would pay more than $67 million in fines to settle fraud charges. Countrywide, you'll remember, was bought by B of A after the mortgage meltdown. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. By Ally Bank, committed to customer service with the option to reach a human being at any time at 877-247-ALLY by pressing 0. And by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly report on industrial production. President Obama hosts the White House Science Fair, an incentive to do your homework. And if you're planning to start the week with diet and exercise, I've got bad news for you. It's National Chocolate Cupcake Day. Other days celebrate the petite confection, but Monday is just for chocolate. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Gold couldn't quite keep the levels it hit earlier this week today, but those high prices do have people scrounging through their jewelry boxes to find gold they're not interested in anymore. And they don't really have to look too far for a place to cash in. Gold brokers are only too pleased to buy your jewelry and melt it down. Politicians in Chicago, though, are distinctly not keen on more cash for gold stores popping up there. Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold reports.
If you have trouble sleeping, you may be familiar with ads like this.
I got $583. All I did was look through my drawer full of jewelry I never wear.
Turn your unwanted or broken jewelry, gold, silver, platinum, rings, chains, and bracelets into cold hard cash.
Or take it down to the local cash for gold store. So many of them are cropping up in Chicago that the city council is considering adding new regulations to slow them down. Alderman Ed Burke says the stores give criminals a quick way to dump their loot for cash.
We can't legislate them into honesty, but we can make it more transparent and let community groups see who is operating the business.
Believe it or not, with the gold here, and I'll just take these watches for parts, you got like $140 worth of stuff here.
That's Bruce Lois giving the good news to a customer. Lois runs Gold Star Jewelry and Coin Company on Chicago's north side. He's got giant rings on every finger and a gold chain around his neck. He says cash for gold stores deserve a closer look.
Because they've cropped up so heavily in the last couple of years, they need scrutiny.
Lois's family has been in the business for generations. His store wouldn't be subject to the new city regulations. The permits would only be for new gold stores. The city council is expected to vote on the measure next month. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
You want to talk about a stash of gold to sell? How does nearly 9,000 tons hit you? 260 million troy ounces, if you're doing the math. That's the U.S. government's stockpile, more than any country in the world by far. In the current issue of The Atlantic magazine, Jim Paserno wonders aloud whether, given our current financial troubles, we should start selling some of it off. Jim, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So you started asking all these questions about the U.S. gold supply. Anybody answer you?
I got answers, but they weren't all that satisfying. I called the White House. I called some key members of Congress. I called around to the Treasury, and the bottom line is I couldn't get anyone to really have a discussion with me on the record about what are the plans for all the gold that the United States holds. And to me, it was odd in the sense that it's a national asset. And in a time when there's deficits and budgetary problems and all kinds of economic turmoil, it seemed, call me crazy, relatively prudent to talk about something that's a national asset that's worth $300 billion, and give or take. But it's very difficult to get anybody in Washington to talk about it.
Now, the law says that if we wanted to sell it, we could only sell it to bring down the national debt, right?
Right. That's embedded in the U.S. code. Of course, Congress could change that. They wrote it. They can do anything they want with it.
What can we do?
I talked to a number of economists, and a lot of them, or at least some of them, told me that what we shouldn't do is we shouldn't use it to turn around and fund consumption. Mm. You want to use any proceeds from selling gold for something that has some sort of value as a future investment. I mean, one economist told me, and I thought it was a good idea, that if oil was cheap — it's not exactly cheap right now, but let's say oil was cheap and gold is expensive — selling some of the gold and buying oil to put into strategic petroleum reserve might be a good idea, might be a savvy move.
Now, there are some good reasons for not selling this gold. First of all, if we just open the vaults, you know, the price of gold goes to like 14 cents an ounce.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, again, I think there's a very productive debate. I mean, should we hold the gold? Should we sell it? Should we keep some of it? And for the record, European central banks have been selling some of their gold over the last 10, 15 years. Of course, other central banks, particularly in Asia, China and India, have been buying gold. But the biggest argument against selling it is that, well, if you sell it, what are you going to get? You're going to get, at the end of the day, paper dollars. Well, guess what? The Federal Reserve can print up as much dollars as it wants. Right. In fact, it seems to be doing that as we speak.
Jim Paserno, he's the editor of the Beta Investment Report. His article, which is called Uncle Sam's Mysterious Hoard, is in the November issue of The Atlantic magazine. Jim, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
If you've stayed in a hotel room in the past, I don't know what, maybe 10 years, you've seen those little cards by the sink, right? Help us conserve water and energy, they say. Reuse your towels. Starwood Hotels has taken that concept to the next level, to the dismay of the housekeeping staff. Marketplace's Sean Cole explains.
As I methodically walked the floors of Starwood's Sheraton Center Toronto, I kept seeing these cards hanging from the doorknobs. I counted them. Quietly.
Here's one make a green choice card.
They're like do not disturb cards, but they say, in big letters, make a green choice.
12. 13. 14. This is a hot floor.
The card means don't clean my room. Housekeepers can't go in. In exchange, the guest gets a $5 coupon toward food or beverages within the hotel. Because less cleaning saves water and electricity. Fewer chemicals go down the drain. Or that's the hotel's side. The room attendants have another name for the Make a Green Choice program. They call it the Fake Green Choice program.
Yeah, it's fake.
Brigida Ruiz is a shop steward for a union called Unite Here. She's been a room attendant at the Sheraton Center Toronto for 19 years. And she says when you hang that card on your door, you're not just cutting back on water and electricity.
You also cut the hours from the room attendant. If 200 guests hang that tonight, somebody count how many room attendants they have to cut.
Of course, there were only 29 cards out of more than 1,300 rooms the night I went. The point is, less cleaning means fewer cleaners. Ruiz says this is just a sneaky way of reducing payroll. Also, guests already had the option of reusing their sheets and towels. So the only difference Make a Green choice makes, she says, is a messy one.
And they're using it for 3 days to 5 days to 7 days. And when they check out, the room is very bad. It's really filthy, dirty, dusty.
And it takes her 3 times longer to clean it, she says, which requires even more water and cleaning fluid than usual. I called the general manager of the Sheraton, who referred me to parent company Starwood, who never provided someone to interview despite several requests. The company did email a statement saying Make a Green Choice has saved nearly 30 million gallons of water, about 129,000 kilowatts of electricity, and 37,000 gallons of chemicals thus far. This is at more than 160 Sheraton and Westin hotels across North America. Unite Here is doubtful about those stats and has made this a bargaining issue in ongoing contract negotiations. They want to kill the program, just like they were able to do at 5 hotels in Hawaii.
On Kauai, where they have most actively promoted the program, we've seen as much as a 25% loss of work hours in our housekeeping department.
Eric Gill is with Unite Here Local 5 in Honolulu. He says a partner company to Starwood wanted to convert a bunch of hotel rooms into private condos, which again would mean fewer hotel rooms to clean. Negotiations began.
We absolutely needed hotel accommodations to drive our jobs. And so the discussion became how many of this and how many of that. And when we came down to the numbers, the number of hotel rooms they were offering would work if there's no green program.
So the company conceded. Room attendants in Toronto have no such leverage. But the thing I keep coming back to is this.
We believe that most people who assertively care about preserving the environment are the kind of people who would also care about the jobs and livelihoods of the workers in the rooms that they stay in.
Exactly. So the hotel says, help us conserve, and the union says, help us keep our hours, and blah! It's enough to drive socially conscious vacationers insane. All I can tell you is what I'm going to do the next time I go to a Sheraton. Not take the stairs.
I wonder how many floors this hotel has.
43. There are 43 floors. In Toronto, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, our special correspondent David Brancaccio took the high road in the broadcast yesterday. He declined to subject you to Justin Bieber. That leaves it to me, I suppose. Jimmy Fallon did a riff on Bieber on his show the other night. Pop star as economic savant.
Reflections, reflections.
Yeah, man, everyone says it's like the bank's fault. Like, everyone's all like, oh, they shouldn't be handing out subprime mortgages. But it's like when you analyze all the SEC reports and everything, it's like, stop playing. We got to point the finger at Alan Greenspan. It's like that dude lowered the federal funds rate to freaking like 1%. Hello? That's going to cause like crazy inflation in the housing market, dude. Everybody knows that.
Check it out. It's pretty good. There's a link to the video on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org. And on a Friday afternoon, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave up 0.2%. That's 31 points. The Nasdaq picked up 1.3%, 33 points. The S&P 500 gained 0.2%, 2 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is JJ Yule. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, new credit card rules mean that companies can't market to college kids. You ever wonder why?
In the beginning, I was really good, and I paid my bills off every month. And then it was like, oh, I can let this slide. 15 credit cards later, a little bit was a really big number.
Yeah, so that's why. We are back here, same time, same channel, Monday afternoon. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.